From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be, around the nation, across the world, I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later tonight, those special open lines. Here's what's happening. Something strange in Iran, I'll tell you. The first clear pictures of Iran's nuclear site there have been published and analyzed following an explosion at or near the site on November 28th. And they provide another piece of a puzzle. But just what happened there remains a mystery. A report of the explosion was first mentioned in the semi-official Fars News website. Then the report was removed. Then it was finally described as an explosion deriving from a military exercise by Isfahan's governor. Jerry Corsi, of course, author of Atomic Iran, with us. Jerry, something weird is going on. As you well know, I do not believe in coincidences. What do you think is happening?
Well, and I agree with you. I think, George, what's happening is that the war between Israel and Iran has already started in a clandestine fashion. I think this explosion, and I've seen the satellite images of the base that was destroyed, and this base was leveled. I mean, this was not a minor explosion. This was some kind of a major attack. There's hardly anything left standing in that base. And we've had a series of explosions, also explosions outside of Tehran, and now we have a U.S. drone that was captured by Iran. I think it's a step up of the clandestine military activity that spells the beginning of an Iran-Israel war that has already started.
I think you're right, Jerry. I saw a satellite picture today of that site. It truly has been leveled. They showed a before and after. Many of those buildings are gone.
It's pretty shocking. I mean, and it was also a very precise strike. I mean, the buildings are gone, George, in those satellite images, but the ground and the area around the site does not appear to be disturbed. So however the site was destroyed, it was done in a very surgical fashion, but extremely effective. And I think it's really at the beginning of Israeli agents operating in a clandestine fashion inside of Iran, taking out key targets that could be a prelude to a shooting war that we may be on the verge of seeing starting.
Now, if this is happening, and I believe it is, Jerry, I'm confused why Iran, with all their sable rattling earlier, we're going to do this, we're going to launch missiles if we're attacked, they haven't done anything. How come?
Well, I think Iran at this point doesn't want to admit how vulnerable it's been to Israeli attacks. If we go back, we even had cyber attacks on Iran's nuclear power plant that delayed its opening. We've had various Iranian nuclear scientists killed in recent weeks. I think Iran does not want to admit how vulnerable it is, and it's only going to take another provocation or another series of incidents. And I think war could easily break out in the Middle East on a major scale.
Jerry, send us to some of your websites, my friend. What do we have?
Well, WorldNet Daily, where I'm a senior staff reporter. And also 1776nation.com, which is one of my new websites in preparation for a book I plan to write next year.
Okay, my friend Jerry Corsi, we'll be in touch. New research shows that some of the smartphones specifically designed to support the Android mobile platform have incorporated additional features that can be used by hackers to bypass Android security features, making them more vulnerable to attack. Android has the largest share of the smartphone market now in the U.S. A computer scientist says some of these preloaded applications or features are designed to make the smartphones more user-friendly, such as features that notify you of missed calls or text messages. The problem is that these preloaded apps are built on top of the existing Android architecture in such a way as to create potential backdoors that can be used to give third parties direct access to personal information or other phone features. Now, if you're one of the many who often sneak bites of cookie batter while forming little mounds of those sticky sweet stuff for baking, scientists have a message for you. Stop it now. And you better tell the little kids, too. A new report shows that there may be some nasty germs lurking in the ready-to-bake cookie dough. Raw ready-to-bake cookie dough was what caused 77 people in 30 states to become ill, 35 of whom became so sick that they needed to be hospitalized. Our food safety expert, Jeff Nelkin, with us. Jeff, what is it in the cookie dough that would get people sick?
Well, in the past, we've had situations where we found some, you know, eggs that go into the cookie dough.
Aha. Uh-huh.
And the raw eggs had salmonella. Those were a couple of cases. We've even had cases where the chocolate or even the flour could have been contaminated due to filth in the processing facility. So it's not just, you know, the eggs being a situation, but could be other multiple ingredients that go into the cookie dough. Because remember, cookie dough is an unprocessed product. It's not cooked.
I remember as a little kid, I used to do this. You know, Mom would make cookies, and I'd, you know, put my finger across the batter. I lucked out, I guess, Jeff.
I think we all lucked out.
We sure did. Jeff Nelkin's website, foodsafetycoach.com. The average U.S. household lost $21,261 of net worth this summer, the largest decline in family wealth in nearly 3 years. Gone. Bye-bye. The drop in the third quarter tied to falling home values and a cratering of the stock market is the second straight quarter of eroding wealth, according to the Federal Reserve's quarterly report. Look in the western sky Saturday morning before dawn, and if the weather is clear, you're in the right spot. You will be rewarded with an incredible lunar eclipse. For just under an hour, the disk of the full moon will almost disappear, turning a dark, rusty red. And who's watching the skies for us? None other than Stephen Cates, Dr. Sky. Another exciting moment in space, Doctor.
Absolutely, George, and it's exciting. I'm standing here in this beautiful Arizona skies to pull another all-nighter. And I hope the coast audience in the western United States will join us. Starting at officially 4:46 a.m. Pacific Standard Time, look, of course, to the moon. As the left or top edge of the moon, George, goes into the Earth's umbra. What happens with the total lunar eclipse is that the Earth, of course, blocks the light that the moon normally would get, and things get better. At 6:06 a.m. Pacific Standard Time, totality begins. The middle of the eclipse, 6:32 a.m. Pacific Standard Time, and then it ends at 6:57. But this eclipse, George, is probably going to be best seen for those in Hawaii and the Pacific Islands and even out into the areas like the Philippines. And, you know, if you miss this one, put this down on your calendar, folks. The next total lunar eclipse for us in the Americas, April the 15th, tax day of 2014. We also get another one on October the 8th. And it's totally safe to look at, George, with the naked eye. And I'm just hoping that Coast listeners have an opportunity to get those cameras out. And there's always opportunities to share those pictures.
You got that right. Thanks, Stephen. Stephen's website, Dr. Sky, D-R-S-K-Y, drsky.com. Up next, Chad Lewis joins us. We're going to be talking about hidden headlines, very strange and unusual stories. Get ready for some very bizarre stories of ghosts, deaths, sea serpents, and so much more. Next on Coast to Coast AM. Well, Chad Lewis put together a series called Hidden Headlines, incredible series of books. Chad's an author, researcher, lecturer on topics of very strange and unusual things. He has trekked across the world in search of the paranormal, our kind of guy, and has done just about everything from tracking vampires in Transylvania and chasing chupacabras in Puerto Rico to searching for the very elusive monster in Loch Ness. And how about pursuing ghosts in Ireland's castles as well? Chad has spent over 16 years chasing down the unexplained. He was on our program back in April, and he's back on Coast to Coast tonight. Chad, how are you?
Hey, good to hear you, and greetings from Wisconsin.
You are everywhere. I mean, you've got books, Wisconsin, Minnesota. You're all over the place, South Dakota, Florida, Iowa. Now, this one's what, the latest I've seen here, Hidden Headlines of New York. You're everywhere.
Well, luckily, it's unexplained throughout the world, so I'm not forced to be in my Midwestern roots here. I get to travel around, luckily, and explore. And again, luckily for me, the weird is everywhere.
How did you get involved, Chad, looking for these weird, mysterious stories in old newspapers?
Well, with a lot of things, it really happened by mistake. I was doing research on another book of haunted places, and I needed some background information on a couple of the cases I was working on. So at this time, you had to go to the library and look at the newspapers on microfilm or microfiche. And as I was digging through looking for some history on the cases I was working on, I would find a lot of these just weird and odd stories. And I started printing them out just for my own amusement. And I started finding more and more of them. And I thought, if I'm just stumbling across these stories, I wonder how many I could find if I actively searched them out. So that's what I did. I started with my home state of Wisconsin and just started going through the newspapers of the old days one by one and looking for weird headlines. And I was amazed at what I found.
Tell me about the research behind this, Chad. How do you go about digging for stuff like that?
Well, unfortunately for me, back then, they didn't have any databases that they have now where you can type in code words or search words of newspaper archives. So what I had to do is literally day by day go through the newspaper of the time
and look for
any headline that stood out. I always joke that it took probably 10 years off the life of my eyes, but I had to find these cases. And during that time period, it was great. It was really a lot of fun because you really got involved with what it was like back in the early days in some of these states that you would start to see names of prominent people or businesses, and you'd get tied up in some of the town gossip of some of these stories while you were looking for headlines. And I think that was a lot of fun. It was a time portal back to the early days of the paranormal in the U.S.
It's very tedious, though, isn't it?
Yes, it took forever. It took me several years to come up with enough stories for the first book, and now, thanks to a lot of the progress is you can use databases and such. It's narrowed it down quite a bit, but there were days when I would go and not find one story that was paranormal in nature. And then all of a sudden you'd hit one and it felt like winning the lottery.
When you were looking at the articles that were in the old newspapers, did they have bylines? Were they written by reporters or were they just popped into the paper? How did they look?
Well, a lot of them were just a headline and an attention-grabbing headline as well. A lot of these stories that I think the reporters knew they may have had a different explanation, but they went ahead and grabbed the best headline they could. For example, one of my favorites, one of the first I came across was one of a woman who yawned herself to death, and that was the headline, yawns herself to death. Now, actually, she probably had a brain aneurysm or a heart attack, but that didn't sell stories. So these headlines really stood out. And usually they didn't have a reporter's name attached to them as well. And I think some of the fun of these is that they appeared in all the newspapers, but were they true or not? I don't know. Maybe it was just a slow news day for somebody knowing that they could make up this story and nobody was going to Google it back then and find out if it was true. So I think some of these may be so far-fetched that maybe they didn't actually happen.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you. What do we know about the authenticity? Did they sometimes, quote people? Of course, those people are long since gone, but did they have sources in some of the stories?
A lot of the stories did, and you could tell that they went out of their way to give some credibility to the story. They would mention prominent people in the town, bankers, lawyers, law enforcement, that could serve as witnesses, or they would talk about how many witnesses had come forward. There was cases of UFOs where hundreds of people would come forward and report these, so they went out of their way. Other ones were just small little snippets where they gave you just the basic information and then nothing else. I would search for years after this in the newspapers, search for a follow-up story to many of these, and they never appeared. It was just a one-off, as though here's what we have, make of it what you will.
Well, now, how did you pick the year, 1860 to 1910, that time period?
Yeah, really, again, by convenience. What I found is when I was going through the Wisconsin, my first endeavor into this, is that any newspaper stories prior to 1860 were just very difficult to read, and I didn't want to bother myself with that. They just took up way too much time. But I knew I wanted to include the turn of the century because that's when a lot of people really start with some odd beliefs, and also it was the real height of the spiritualist movement, so I knew I would get some good stories there as well. And they just cut it off at 1910 because it was a 50-year period, and it took me long enough to do that period, and I figured maybe somebody else would do from 1911 on.
Chad, give me the category of the topics you went looking for.
Well, I really searched just starting for the weird. I had no categories to start with. But then as I started finding these stories, I put them into categories just to make it easier to kind of classify these, and I did bizarre deaths, ghosts, medical anomalies, mysterious creatures, oddities, which I found were just too weird to be in any of these categories, peculiar people, psychic phenomena, and UFOs. And I found that even the most bizarre story out there usually could fit into one of those categories.
Well, let's go through some of the categories and break them down. One of them, bizarre deaths. Explain that one, Chad.
Well, this is not like it is today. When you read the newspaper today, you'll read a story of a death. It'll say Mr. Lewis died peacefully at home, surrounded by his loving family. That didn't happen back during this time period. One thing, they were much more graphic in their description of death. If Mr. Lewis took a shotgun and ended his life, they put all the grisly details in there as well. But it was also a time when, again, they were looking to sell newspapers. So they would put things together that you knew might not have caused death, but it was an interesting story. Things of a man who took a cold bath, dropped dead from the cold bath. A little girl who was in excellent shape, just got done jump roping 100 times, and she dropped dead. I mentioned the woman who yawned herself to death. People talking about drinking lemonade, and they dropped dead. Even had a case out of California where a gentleman was discussing death, and he dropped dead in the middle of his discussion. And to make matters more bizarre, his brother, 2 years prior, was also in a heated discussion about death and dropped dead as well. So it seemed to be something plaguing this family.
I guess it was this period, too, that was so sensational for Ripley, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. And Ripley's one of my idols, Robert Ripley, and he took a lot of these stories and brought them to the forefront as well. And he of course, you know, claimed to have traveled to over 200 countries collecting all these stories. And I think he really piqued the fascination of the general public in America. And I think that's why a lot of these newspapers were covering these stories, because he got he showed that Americans were really interested in these topics.
Did the stories change from one part of the country over another?
They did. A lot of them stayed the same. When somebody passed away, or a UFO, or these mysterious creatures. But the belief in them changed throughout the country. When I was doing the book on the Texas stories, I found that, you know, they were less likely to believe in some of the psychic phenomenon than some of the northern states, but they were more likely to believe in a lot of the ghost stories as well. They took it for granted that these stories happened. And I think that's part of the fun, is seeing the regional differences in these stories. And even up until today, you get those regional differences of some of these historic cases, where out west you'll have ghosts of the Wild West characters, where here in the Midwest we have a lot of Native American lore of spirits and that. And that was evident back then as well.
Were there any stories that were too hot to handle or too strange?
I think that's a great question, in the fact that I don't believe so. The newspapers were pretty open, whether it was a story that was sexist, racist, or again, made up, I don't know. But I don't think anything was off limits back then. They were grisly in their description. They didn't pull any PC editing of their stories. And they covered just the wildest stories you can imagine, from just weird people doing weird things to unidentified flying objects. So I don't think they edited or threw out any of these stories. I think the more bizarre it was, the more the readers ate it up.
Well, they loved that. And then, of course, Hearst started picking up on the very strange stories. He seemed to push that as well, didn't he?
Yeah. And I think these strange stories, there were a lot of newspapers that carried just these national strange stories, and there'd be a section of 8 or 10 of these stories, and just bizarre things. It could be from, you know, a pack rat stealing everybody's money in a workshop, you know, just odd little things like that, or people being buried alive, and of course psychic phenomena at that point, when the spiritualist movement was at its height. That was one that newspapers couldn't get enough of, these stories of people foretelling their own death or being saved by dreams, things of that nature.
All right. Well, stay with us, Chad. We're going to come back and talk much more with you about these incredible stories in your book, Headlines of the Very Strange and Unusual. And then we'll be right back with more of these strange stories. So if somebody opened the door and said, come on in, friend, would you? Well, you probably would. And that's what we do if you're a member of the Coast Insiders Club. Come on in. For less than 25 cents a day, you too can be a member. We get downloads, podcasting, part of our weekly and then our monthly series of information that we send out. Also, our monthly video chats or our regular chats as well. Simply go to coasttocoastam.com. At the top of the homepage, it'll say Coast Insider. And join up. Be a member of the club for less than 25 cents a day. And welcome back to Coast, Chad Lewis with us. Chad, first of all, where do you get all these books and these stories? Where do people pick them up?
Well, I always say you can pick them up from your favorite bookseller or, of course, online as well, as most people like to. But, yeah, you'll have no trouble finding them. You have to go out of your way to avoid some of these.
All right. They're everywhere. Now, let's talk about some of the urban legends that you stumbled across. Any come to mind?
Yeah, well, one that a lot of people think is an urban legend of people being buried alive. And I hear a lot of people say that makes for a good horror movie, but it never really happened. Well, I believe thousands of people were buried alive. And the reason for this is that I have thousands of newspaper reports that people, whether they were in a diabetic shock or in a coma, the doctors of the time pronounced them dead. But the newspaper reports reported that oftentimes, even at their own funeral, they would pop up just in the nick of time. They would break out from this coma or their sickness, and they'd be saved from being buried alive. So you can imagine how many people didn't pop up in that time and that were buried alive. It's a gruesome thing to think of, but I have so many of these cases where people just in the nick of time, they were saved. And by some odd chance of just waking up at the right time, that you kind of feel sorry for those who didn't.
Sometimes, what did they do? They had bells in there and things like that?
Yeah, it seems a little silly to us today with modern medicine, but our great-grandparents came up with several devices to stop this. One was a spring-loaded coffin from the inside that if anything moved on the inside, it would pop the lid open of the coffin so you could crawl out. But they also came up with the idea of that cemetery bell that is exactly what it sounds like, a bell that would have sat over your grave with a rope going down or a cord into your casket. So if you awoke to find yourself buried alive, all you'd have to do is pull that rope, and it would, of course, ring the bell and alert the caretaker of the cemetery that you had been buried alive. But the problem was is that on many nights, the wind would set some of these bells off, giving the caretaker quite a scare, thinking everybody was buried alive.
Oh, my gosh. So sometimes he ignored it, and I wonder if he ignored it when people were trying to get out for real.
Yeah, exactly. That's a great point. And just how horrific would that be to know that you invested in this cemetery bell, you're ringing it, and yet nothing happens because they think it's a false alarm.
Oh, it's only the wind. Let him stay. And he's down there trying to get out. Oh, my gosh, that would be horrible. Let's talk a little bit about the stories of a sighting of a wild man. Could that have been Bigfoot?
Yeah, these stories of the wild man or wild men really fell into two categories. And one would be the obvious hermit that lived out in the woods, usually thought to be insane. He was a gentleman who let his whiskers or his beard grow long, his hair was long, and he was filthy, a mess. And it was usually, again, just somebody who thought that they wanted to live on their own and live out in the outdoors. That was the one type that was often reported. The second type, I think, would be a little bit closer to what we think of the Bigfoot or Sasquatch. These were the creatures that were reported to be very tall in height, over 7 feet tall, very muscular, covered in this deep, dark, matted down fur. People said they were a hairy monster at that point. Of course, they didn't know gorillas, or they didn't say it was an ape back in the early parts because they didn't know what that was. So I think that was certainly probably very close to what we would consider the Bigfoot of today, that they were seeing these wild men. And I'm amazed at how many communities were terrorized by these wild men throughout the years. They would put together posses of hundreds of men that would go out looking for these creatures after People were terrified by them, and they always ended up empty-handed, unless, of course, they found that hermit out there.
Now, that's a great story. Let's talk about some medical anomalies that you stumbled across. What was that?
Well, a lot of these medical anomalies, I think science could explain today. I have cases where people changing colors was one of the ones that they love to talk about quite a bit. You know, Caucasians turning black, African-Americans turning white. And obviously it was a skin condition, but they thought it was some type of voodoo curse. And people dying of weird things as well. You have medical anomalies of turtles and ringworms and living inside of people. I had cases where people were throwing up 5 to 10 inch turtles that they were thought to have swallowed years ago when they were kids. So all these strange things, and they would put in the weird people in there as well. Like I had a case out of Wisconsin of a strange maniac who eats hay, and they put him in the medical anomalies as well because they couldn't figure out what he was doing. Or the gentleman who went around barking like a dog, obviously he was insane, but they put that in there as the headline instead of insanity. It was man thinks he's dog, or is he part dog.
Did people believe these stories then?
I think they did. For the most part, they did. They had some skepticism toward them, but I think they liked it and they wanted to believe it. And a lot of the times, the beliefs of this period really coincided with these stories, that it wasn't strange for people to hear of these because they knew somebody in the community that had had that happen to them. So I think even more so than today, I think the general public believed a lot of these stories and found them to be true.
Some of the other stories that you've covered about bones of a giant, how come we don't hear too much about that other than through our guest Stephen Quayle that we've talked about? But what did you find?
Well, I think today it doesn't seem as fascinating when we find remains of a 7-foot or 8-foot person because people are so much bigger now. But back in the late 1800s, early 1900s, when the average American male was only 5 feet 6 inches tall, when you found remains from a 100-year grave of somebody 7-8 foot tall, they really would be considered a giant. And I think that really fascinated people at that time. And this was a time when they were digging up a lot of the effigy mounds of the Native Americans and the mound builders. And they were fascinated when they found these giant remains. Also, I think the hoaxes, like the Cardiff giant hoax, that really soured the reader on these giants. But I'm still fascinated by these large people that they discovered, even today when we know that people get to great heights. But I don't know why we don't hear as much in the mainstream media. I think it's just as fascinating.
This was a time period as well, Chad, where P.T. Barnum was at his height doing the things that he did. Did people believe him?
Well, I don't think so. Barnum, of course, the showman, the greatest showman to ever walk the planet, as many claim, and I tend to agree with that. He was bringing in both real phenomena that he could find and real freaks of nature, as he called them. And when he couldn't secure them or find them, he invented them. And what was fascinating when you read a lot of Barnum's writing is that when the general public found out that they were being hoaxed, it actually increased the attendance to his dime museums and his museums of the weird and unusual, is that people wanted to come in to try to solve these cases. We had a case here in Wisconsin of the infamous Hodag, this creature that was supposedly caught out in the forest by these lumberjacks in Wisconsin, and it was a hideous-looking creature, you know, part alligator, part rhinoceros-looking beast, and they actually thought they captured him, and they charged people a small fee to come and see it in its lair in Rhinelander, Wisconsin, and word got out that it was a hoax made up to draw tourists in town, and more people came to see how they hoaxed it than that came to see it believing it was real. So I think Barnum really was a genius in that it didn't matter if these things were real or not. People paid to see it.
Now, what kind of stories would be all over the place today if most newspapers covered some of these? You know, a few of them do on the Internet, but we don't get that widespread coverage. But If papers would cover it today, what kind of stories would they cover? Similar ones?
I would like to think so. I think the psychic phenomena would be one where papers could cover it and still have fun with it. There were a lot of these foretelling of death. There was a girl in Iowa in 1910. Her and her mother were out shopping, and they saw a funeral pass by them, and the young girl commented to her mother that, well, tomorrow they'll come and get me. And sure enough, the very next day, she passed away, unexplained death. And a lot of these people, what I found interesting, and this might be even a heartfelt story for people today, is that when a lot of people had dreams that they were going to die, and they would tell relatives and friends that this is the date and the time I'm going to go, and they'd go out and do one thing before they died. And I always ask when I'm doing lectures, people to take guesses what they did, and no one ever gets it. They went out and paid off all of their debts to the community and to the people they owed so that when they died, their family would have a clear name and they would die with a clear name themselves. And I always kind of find it funny that today, you know, we'd probably do the exact opposite, go out and charge up everything because you're about to die.
Well, you know what? That's a very possible situation. And as you look at all of these cases that are out there, did you find that psychic phenomena was pretty high on their list back then?
It was, and it was in two camps really as well, that you had all this psychic phenomena that people, you know, foretelling of dreams. I had a case of a woman that was woken up in the middle of the night with this dream that monsters were visiting her down in Chicago, and these monsters were tormenting her in her dream, and she woke up just in time to find that the gas had been left on. And she grabbed off all of her kids, and they stormed out, and, you know, it was thought this dream saved her life. But then we also have the psychic phenomenon that was attributed to an act of providence or an act of spiritual healing, an act of God, where it was a good news, bad news scenario. And I think you'll like this, George, that people would often be cured of their blindness, or they would get their sight back, they'd get their hearing, even their ability to walk again. But the bad news of the story was that it often meant they would die within a month or two after getting this act of God healing them. So it was, again, a good news, bad news. Good news is you'll get this function back. The bad news is it'll cost you your life.
What were some of the UFO stories of the past?
Well, I like these UFO stories of the past. One is that, you know, keep in mind that so many people spent more time outside when nearly all of the people of that time period were involved with farming to some extent, some family member was. They spent more time outdoors watching. They would sit out on their porch at night waiting for it to cool off inside the house so they could go in. So I think they studied the sky a lot more than most people do today. And I always tell people that, you know, just as an experiment for the next week, you know, keep track of how long you spend at night staring out at the sky. And if you're like most people, it's probably not a lot of time. But so these people were more aware of, I think, the skies around them, of what was going on. And the UFOs at that time period, believe it or not, a lot of them, I was amazed at how long they would sit in the sky. I had cases after case after case of hundreds of witnesses watching an object, usually a bright light at that time, that would float into town, hover for 20, 30 minutes, and then move on to the next town and do the same thing. And you could follow the progression of this UFO by the newspaper stories that you could follow it from town to town because the towns would alert each other that keep an eye out for this. We just saw it. And that was fascinating as well. Not as many craft stories as I thought or objects, a lot more lights. And that really surprised me. Of course, I did get the stories of, you know, people seeing a craft that they believed wasn't a balloon or some type of flying mechanism that they couldn't explain. But a lot of it was these balls of light or these shields of light flying around.
The great story in the 1800s, of course, in Texas, was a occupant of some kind of craft that crashed, and they buried him, and they thought he was an alien. Remember that story?
Yeah, it happened down in Aurora, Texas, 1897.
That's right.
And one of the articles I found went into detail about it, that the ship crashed down and it took out a windmill on this farm, and all the residents found the body of what they thought was a being not of this earth, and they had no idea what to do with it, and they simply buried it in their cemetery, and the cemetery's still there. You can go down there and visit the cemetery. Of course, nobody's found the body, or they don't know where it's buried, supposedly inside of the cemetery. But yeah, they thought that they captured it. And it's amazing that going through searching for that story, is it didn't appear in as many papers as you would think it did. It was kind of a local event. People thought not a lot about it, and they buried him, this creature, and went about their business.
What did you find to be one of the most bizarre stories or oddest cases?
Well, I think besides the people of the U.S., the mysterious creatures, and not the creatures that we would consider like the fearsome creatures, like in New York in 1909, this unidentified creature was terrorizing pigs and watchdogs. All it would do is eat the heads off these creatures, and they find the mauled remains of dozens of these guard dogs and pigs and livestock, and they never found that what that creature was. Those were fascinating creatures. There was a case in my hometown of Eau Claire of this panther-like beast causing terror around town, killing livestock, chasing kids home at night. He was never captured, or it was never captured. But I like the stories of these creatures I never heard of. Like in Texas, I had a case where it was reported that a creature was born that was half human, half centipede. In New York, there was a half-human, half-monkey that was said to be running around. And what's fascinating about these is they were probably just kids born with medical diseases.
Deformities. Yeah.
But what's fascinating is reading at that time, what I found is that when a woman was pregnant back during this time period, if she was scared by any type of creature, whether it was a snake or an elephant, legend was that that child would come out looking like the creature that scared the mother. So when we had this human fish being born down in Texas, it was believed that the mother was scared by the father bringing home fish. So you get all these weird, mysterious creatures that I never heard of before.
You know, I could see in those days, without radio, without television, people grabbing their newspapers and just talking about this. You know, like the old days with the water cooler stories at the office, I bet they talked about these in the pubs or wherever they went and congregated.
Yeah, you're certainly right about that. And they were really tourist destinations that even something what we would consider, you know, not that interesting today, a two-headed pig or, you know, six-legged calf being born, they would be brought to these places where they were born, the farms and what be it. And people would drive out there on, you know, their horse or their buggy, or even back when the cars came in, they would drive out and pay a little fee to see these, and they would be a great entertainment value, and the whole town would be abuzz about these paranormal experiences going on. It was really made up a lot of entertainment.
Well, nowadays, people, do you think, would believe most of these stories if they were all published on the Internet or in newspapers or if they heard it on this show?
I think people are a lot more skeptical today of things that they don't experience themselves, whether it's because of Photoshop or all these hoaxes coming out. When you see a video or a photograph, people are very skeptical unless they see it or take it themselves. And for a lot of people, that's what's happening. They're coming face to, well, I guess not really face with some of these other things, and they're believers in that aspect. But I think a lot of people would be skeptical of these stories because we've been thrown so many hoaxes out there.
Well, maybe so, but that would be the times, and they are a change in chat. So what's next for you? Where do you go hunting next?
Well, I kind of get back into today's world, and I'm working on a book of sea serpent sightings from the old days leading up to today as well. And back in the time period of this, sea serpents were all over, hundreds upon hundreds in the U.S. Just in my home state of Wisconsin, we had dozens of lakes that were thought to be inhabited by these sea serpents. And then sometime around 1930, people stopped reporting them or the newspapers stopped writing about it, and they kind of dwindled down to nothing. And
luckily, or they died.
Yeah, they possibly had died out the last one. But luckily today, more and more people are reporting these. In Minnesota, there's a little city on Lake Pepin on the Mississippi River that's offering a
$50,000
reward.
Hold on for a minute. Let's get that story from you when we come back. Plus, we're going to take phone calls with Chad Lewis, questions for him. And if you have a very mysterious story that you think would have been in the paper in the 1800s, share it with us. We'll be back.